Hello everyone and welcome to the most monetized podcast in the world, House of Games. Today I'm joined by my brother from another mother, at least if you want to believe in the conspiracy theorists. Oh no! But before we head down that rabbit hole, let's dive into today's episode of House of Games.
Hello everyone and welcome to this episode of House of Games. And this week we are going to talk about monetization of all kinds. So I'm thinking we could go into, we'll see, as a usualist, we have a plan from the beginning and then we derail somewhere and jump off a cliff. But I'm
and usually end up in AI land. Something tells me we're going to end up there today as well.
Yeah, might be. But the way I'm thinking, at least at this stage, is that we sort of go through the whole journey of monetization for games, starting perhaps with games as a product, as it usually is, and then end somewhere with, you know, microtransactions and DLC and stuff like that. Crypto, perhaps, we'll see. So I guess definitions first of all. So games as a product, I think it's the model that everyone knows and loves, at least in the 90s kids generation. And basically you make a game, you sell it and charge an amount per copy, and then you hopefully earn enough to make the next game and then do it again. Good rating, 10 out of 10. Like it a lot.
Yeah, I think that's the best way of doing things. And it also keeps, somehow I feel like it's the most honest way and keeps the developer and everyone sort of real to their product or more honest towards what they're doing, not this sort of, release a half-ass product and hope to make money later on or whatever. But yeah, keep going with the definitions.
Yes, and I think also the incentives for different payment models also in some way affects how the game is made and planned and all of that. So I'm thinking as well that doing it as a product, that incentivizes that you have to make the product as good as possible and then, you know, make it like quality should be the major factor in deciding whether to buy it or not. We'll get to the other ones, but then we have, I guess, what started coming out, I guess, in the, I don't know, probably someone can fact check me, but I remember at least that it became more and more expansions, as it was called back in the day. So you would make a game, for example, Age of Empires. And then you would make, maybe a year or 2 years later, you would make an expansion for that game. So it was basically it required you to have the original game, and then you bought a pack that usually gave you more maps or more main characters or more missions or more gameplay, basically, and was usually somewhere along like half of the game in size, something like that, that you would buy for something like half the price. After that, I guess, I think many people, I don't know if it's true, but they attribute Bethesda as the sort of one of the first people to do DLCs, which is downloadable content. But I think what people are thinking about specifically is not just downloadable, but rather that you have something like an expansion, but it's usually a lot smaller, and then you pay per thing. So in the case of Bethesda and the Elder Scrolls 4 Oblivion, it was the horse armor, which is basically you can buy for, say, let's say $5 or something, you could buy armor for your horse.
I have back when that happened, I actually wrote like an article about it on a website called Epic Battle Cry, and then they changed name to The Outlaws. So that was my favorite podcast back in the days, Lauren, Brent, Daniel Kaiser, and Tony, yeah, what are the name of these people? It was a fantastic podcast. It was on game trailers, so it's that old. But anyway, I wrote this little thing about the horse armor, because back then that was like a thing about these items you can buy and so on. And I remember writing this article, whatever you want to call it, a blog thingy, that it's gonna get worse. And this had already happened, that horse, as I said before, the Trojan horse, the sort of the one that snuck in and just fucked everything up. That's literally how it started. And then it's fun to see that I was somewhat right back then, that it's just gonna get worse and more ingredients and so on. But I remember that one. It was insane. It was like $5 for that horse armor. And that's the saddest part, that, or like, we were fine with that back then. Now for $5, you need to like offer a 20-hour experience or something, or people just refuse to buy it if it's $5. But it's too expensive, man. It's just insane what's happened in such short time. Like, the bar has risen or lower itself. I'm not quite sure how to use that bar metaphor, but it's just like what you have to do to get a DLC out there and people are going to be feel happy about it and happy to buy it is insane. And you just remember, we paid $5 for a horse armor.
Well, I didn't. I just got it through illicit means. Ooh. But... you know, but you also have to remember that for the Elder Scrolls, at least, they did have DLCs which were, or I don't know if you would classify them as expansions, but for example, the Shivering Isles, which was like something like 20 hours at least, that added. So they had like both that and the horse armor, so I guess it wasn't only bad. And then I guess, as you say, the journey continued and the transactions became smaller and smaller for smaller and smaller things. So eventually you could buy skins and stuff for just $1 and then,
Yeah, I wonder if that was, like, they saw that in the numbers. They made the Shiver Islands or whatever it was called. And I think they charged $20, let's say. And then they did the horse armor and that was $5. I wonder if they sort of compared these two, like, where did we benefit the most from an horse armor that took a programmer one day to make, or the Shiver Island that we took like 20 people to make in 4 months and we had to hire voice actors and music and all that stuff. And then they sort of compare these two, and like, I wonder if that's how it sort of started, this microtransaction stuff too, that maybe those numbers leaked out to others, or the developers at Bethesda told others, like, oh, we made shitloads of this horse armor, you should look into that.
Yeah.
Conspiracy theory.
Yeah, probably. Or I would say that something that you can't forget in this whole debate, I guess, that people do often forget, it seems to me, that sure, it would be amazing if everything was just games as a product and everything was made like in the 90s. But I think that you can't forget that the people who make games have to feed their families, and money can't come from nowhere. So eventually people are just going to do it to make money, I guess.
But I think still that we gamers are just too much to blame, because like, from a spoiled perspective, because you say people have to feed their families and so on, but they did that back in the day too, and they sold way less games back then. But I have heard that the gaming, console gaming especially, have sort of stagnated to a certain degree. So it's not growing in terms of people playing games in the console space, but their prices and so on goes up. But maybe we play more than we used to. However, the reason why I would assume that they have to make all the find all these loopholes to make more money, it's not just because they are greedy. Maybe they're not. Maybe it's just a necessary means to be able to pay all the salaries and so on. And those salaries are going up because, I mean, the teams are getting bigger and so on. So it's not just like they want to make money. I'm sure there is way more to it. And like, you have to... yeah, like I said, we are also to be blamed because we just want better, bigger, better in every single way. But imagine if we were just sort of satisfied with the graphics from PlayStation 4 or PlayStation 3. And then that's it. Like, a team didn't have to be 500 people. It could just be, you know, 60 people or something like that.
Yeah.
So I think it's that we as gamers are not innocent in this greediness, and also that we keep buying this shit. So
yeah, exactly. It goes back to that saying, you get what you pay for, and people do pay for it. So I 100% agree that, you know, none of this would happen if it weren't for that people would actually buy it. But I think the difference that people don't think about when it comes to the 90s and now, that is that in the 90s, as I understand it at least, the threshold for making games was quite a lot higher. You know, you didn't have Unity or Unreal or something where you could learn to make games on your own, or you could, there's tons of tutorials and stuff, and you can make so much for free. Back then, I guess you would have to pay millions of dollars to use an engine, or you would have to make it from scratch. And even now, there's not a lot of people who can make a good game engine. So I think that now you have a guy in his underwear made Stardew Valley and made millions of dollars. And, you know, a guy, I don't know if it was the same in the story, but at least Minecraft got started as an indie and made billions and so on. So I think with just the technical development making it so much easier, then you have a lot of more people making games, which means, and the population and the market for games doesn't increase in the same speed, I think. So there's going to be fewer consumers per game company, and therefore they just have to compete not only on making the games, but also on how to monetize them. So I think that more game companies means more ways of monetizing. So then there's a lot of more companies that have to get by, you know, doing microtransactions or selling skins or whatever it is. And then maybe if you are like this giant company like Blizzard, for example, then you can make a remake of Warcraft 3 or something and sell it as a product because you can afford the risk and your name is big enough that you can almost guarantee that you will sell millions and millions of copies.
Yeah, it's... Yeah, this kind of stuff makes me so matt. What's that in English? I remember when we talked to the girl from SmartZone about monetization and so on. And I remember asking her sort of like, exhausted is the word I'm looking for. I remember asking her like, sort of like, what's the next plans you have in ways of monetizing and making more money? And she was sort of like laughing at it, like, well, I'm not going to tell you our secrets and so on. But I sort of wanted to ask, or I asked her, or I tried to ask her, like, is there like a limit we can reach in terms of how to monetize shit? And like, and now I'm thinking, at what point is it just so much that we can't comprehend it anymore? Like it's just gonna make the consumer exhausted. I told you many times, just like opening Discord drives me batshit crazy when it's 15 updates, and then it's like, have these pop-up screens everywhere that you do this and now you do this, and it's just like, no, I'm out. Try to start if I start my PlayStation now, like, he asked me to log in, he asked me to credit card numbers, all these crap, and it's just like, I just want to sit down and play a fucking game. And it's just like, a great example, I bought Hot Wheels, the toys. There's a game on Steam, super fun, but man, it's just so much in your face to buy all this crap all the time, and just the menus themselves just feels, I get exhausted just messing around in the menus just to get into the game. But now I sort of got into the game and I know how to play the game, and I'm just trying to ignore all the other crap that is around you and these loot boxes that you get from points and so on. And it's so sneaky how they sneak in these cars among your own cars, but they have a small sort of a trolley symbol on them, and then when you click on them, it takes you to the Steam page to buy them. So it's a super sneaky ways it's obviously so aimed towards kids, and I think that's the most egregious and terrible thing about it, because my son saw me play this game, and then of course he saw this little dinosaur truck in my garage of all these toy cars. This game is not for, I mean, it's for kids, but not that young, as my son, he can barely play Mario Kart, and that plays itself. So, but he likes to just watch me play it. So, but that was enough for him to be, yeah, buy that, used to dino car. And I'm like, no, I'm not going to do it. I have to buy it. I'm not going to do it. So, but it's just so obvious. And this sort of how it's aimed towards kids, I think it's really, it's kind of evil, but also in this world where parents can't say no anymore, it just makes it even worse, because parents just fucking suck at saying no. I'm not one of them, but most parents do. They know, okay, buy it. It's just, oh, it drives me nuts.
Yeah, totally. I agree. I mean, it's one thing to have a game where it's DLCs and skins and stuff, and say Sea of Thieves, for example, where is it a free game? Don't remember. Maybe there's a cost for it, but anyhow, they have like skins and all of that stuff. But that's for, as they say, consenting adults. But with kids, there's just something else that either there's like these stories that you hear about, that there's this 4-year-old that bought $100,000 of skins from his dad's credit card or something, or as you say, parents who can't say no, and it's basically you pay $5 for a JPEG or a texture on the same model, for example. Which is just feels icky.
Yeah.
But yeah.
But it all, yeah, in that case with parents and so on, it all goes back to the parents. I refuse to blame companies for this. It's just fucking parents need to man up and tell their kids to shut up and just play the free stuff. It's that simple.
Yeah. But let's do something else than other people do. Let's do the devil's advocate version of this argument. So would you say that there is some legitimate use for these things, and why?
Well, the one I think about is I can't give many examples where they do this, but what I do think, I'm thinking like EA, for example. They make these football games every year. You're basically just paying for a new roster every year, and they make millions upon millions and millions and millions. But with all that cash, they can make proper games, in my opinion. I mean, I don't play sports game at all. So I would like to believe, and I hope that like my time I spent in Dead Space 1 and 2 in particular is like a byproduct from all of those FIFA products they've sold over and over and over again. And all those ephemeral serves, I believe that in these FIFA games, you can buy card packs or something like that within the game. And that's a huge business for them, to sell these football players within the game. I'm not quite sure how it works, but it's some sort of loot box system. I believe they're trying to make this illegal in Europe. However, I would like to believe that all of this money you make from this very simple, I'm sure making these systems takes a lot of time, but in terms of the profits they make from these systems, for example, selling these football players within the game, I would like to believe that all of that money leads to these products that I like to play, that Dead Space, or I mean Josef Fares with the It Takes Two and Brothers. I believe that's a part of this EA original program, and I also like to believe that all the money they make hand over fist from the FIFA games is money that goes into this program that can finance and make these less profitable games, but these games that are nonetheless probably more important for the medium as a whole, from an artistic and storytelling perspective. So that's definitely the devil's advocate I can come up with, and I think that's a legit and good way of looking at it. But in terms of like just making money for the sake of making money or satisfying the shareholders, that I can live without. Obviously, the company need to satisfy them, but honestly, I would rather see a company go bankrupt than just making shit for the sake of satisfying the shareholders. In a weird way, I just think that, like I said before, this whole idea that truth finds a way But in this case, it's just like real products finds a way. I remember when the economy crashed some years ago, Elon Musk from Tesla said something like, after this, we will see what companies survives, and these are the companies that actually have some sort of value. He said something along those lines.
Yeah.
So basically, it's just to get rid of all the shit. And as a crypto guy, I know that when the crypto market crashed last time, you see all these shit coins, they're called, that just goes to zero because they had no value. Yeah. There was no value there. It was just like to make quick cash on them, which is great if you get in early and you make a lot of profits. But in the end of the day, it's just a crap product that no one needs and no one wants. But the products that survived from that crypto crash, Ethereum and Bitcoin, Solana and so on, these have something. There is still something there. But it doesn't mean that they are actual products that are good for whatever. But let's say they survive forever, Bitcoin, for example. Well, that means because it has some sort of value and people actually value this stuff. So, you know, same way with the gaming industry. Like if big companies go bankrupt because they just make crap products and try to satisfy the shareholders, I wouldn't care too much, because in a weird way, even if there are companies that makes the games I like the most, if you sort of like not put yourself in the center and zoom out a little bit and look at this as a whole, I would imagine that it's a good thing that some companies don't survive, because obviously they're not creating stuff that we need or want.
Yeah.
So, yeah, do you have anything on that to play the devil's advocate on
exactly. I dare to go one step beyond.
Oh.
Yeah, so I would say, have you played Sea of Thieves?
I haven't. I heard it's coming to PlayStation, and it looks gorgeous. So I am quite excited to get it back in Sweden, because we're going to get a new TV, and I think it's going to look legit on an OLED. Anyway.
Cool. Very nice. Well, I would say, again, I don't remember if I paid money for it or if it's a freemium game. But, so, anyhow, after you possibly buy the game, the rest of the game is multiplayer and it's free to play forever, basically. You could do all of the quests, you can do all of the things, it's completely free. And the thing where they have monetization is in skins, mostly, I think. I don't remember seeing anything that, you know, get this gun that's better than all of the other ones, cost $5. I don't remember seeing anything of that. I only remember seeing skins. So, I think that's, and as I've heard it, at least from somewhere, so this is no science, so take it with a grain of salt, but what they say is that these kind of games, they have like 1% of people buy a shit ton of stuff, and that sort of funds the whole experience for everyone else. And so I guess that's how Sea of Thieves works as well. So you have a multiplayer pirate game, you can play it, and if you just don't care about the buying things, then you won't suffer from it. But at least you get updates and support for the game continuously, even though you don't pay for it, because somebody else pays.
Mm. According to that scientist you talked to who said that to you, I heard a similar thing about first class in airplanes. If you can book the... If an airline has fully booked first class seats, it pays for the whole flight, and the rest of the passengers are just sort of gravy on top that can maybe work towards their... You know, saving for the company for an airplane crash or whatever, all the other things that comes around running an airline company. Anyway, I think what I like about this, what I hear now from Sea of Thieves, is that to me that also speaks of, when you describe it, all I was thinking is like, that speaks of a company or a studio who believes in their product. They believe in it because they give it for free. And because you wouldn't want to buy those skins at all if you have no interest in the game or the world. So they, and even if, I mean, you said 1% pays a lot of money. I would still imagine that there are some, let's say, another 20% who maybe buys one or two skins and so on. But to me, that speaks of a confidence in your product. You give it out for free and you know people are going to like it. And you know people want to be in that world, and at that point, that's when they probably want to buy skins for their characters because they get so invested in the world. And yeah, so that's a cool way of doing it. I'm way too cheap for that kind of stuff. I would never buy. I am
same.
I should never say never, but I don't think I would buy anything. Maybe I would do it in order to support the studio, because I'm very much like that, like the Godot thing. I donated to them just because I want them to survive. So I very much like that. So I would probably buy a skin or two to support the studio if I enjoy the game, of course.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think it's a great thing. You know, occasionally when you go to the store to buy, I don't know, ammo or whatever it is. Don't remember, but I think you see, you know, these premium things that you can buy. So I think that's Sea of Thieves is a good model for how you can do it. Another that we didn't discuss before in this episode, I think, is monthly subscriptions. I think that's also a very good way of doing at least multiplayer games that doesn't sort of harm the game, but rather keeps it alive and also incentivizes to keep it going and keep it fresh, so to speak.
The only problem I have with subscription services is that, for example, on Patreon, I subscribed to a lot of creators before. Just a small, you know, a little bit per month to maybe 10, 15 people or something at maximum. But, and again, it's just as a gesture to show support. But I remember, I think it was around the time my son was born, I decided to sort of stop subscribing to so many things. And that's, I started to look at my bank account and see where money was going. Because this is the problem when you subscribe to a bunch of stuff, that you forget where the money is going. You forget about your subscription service. And my wife and I, we have this sort of rule. We only have Netflix. So even though we want to watch The Last of Us on HBO, we're like, no, we're not going to subscribe to anything. We only have one thing and that's it. And we say we either wait for it to come here or we buy the DVD or whatever when it comes out, or Blu-ray. But that's our sort of rule, because we both thought it was, we have some friends, they subscribe to like five different streaming services. It's crazy. Like, how much? It's crazy. So that would be the only thing I would worry about in this sort of subscription service method, because then it's, I mean, for the consumer, it kind of sucks when you forget about these things. But I would also imagine, but from a company point of view, that's great. But I would also imagine, though, that if you subscribe to one game, it must be, something tells me that you're gonna spend a lot of time in that game, which I suppose is great for you, but for the industry as a whole, if we really take that to the extreme, imagine if there's only five big companies and now you have five games to subscribe to, because people don't have time to play in any other games, because these are the ones you subscribe to, which is also my conspiracy theory I have. It's weird, this, I can squeeze in some conspiracy theory in this episode, even though that intro had nothing to do with anything. But my suspicion is that you want these big game companies want to be the one, and then when we enter Matrix, you will basically, you would either enter the PlayStation Matrix, the Nintendo Matrix, the Xbox Matrix, which seems to, they didn't survive, I think. I think they're going to go third platform, third party, or whatever, right? So that's the end goal of all of this madness, is that you subscribe to one company and then they will open the Matrix gates, and then you're in that Matrix, in that parallel universe, if you will. Ah, that's an even cooler thing. That could be a parallel universe situation. You go into the Nintendo Matrix, I go into the PlayStation Matrix, and so on. But anyway, that's I think that's where it's heading long term.
Yeah. Well, I would say it's a lot of stuff to take in. But I would say, so my favorite example of monthly subscriptions is RuneScape. I don't know if you play that, but so they have a really great model, I think, that would be fun to do one day if you would have the resources. But they basically have this open world, which is an MMORPG. Basically, there's a big map. You can go wherever you want, do whatever you want, or, you know, whatever you want. It's like, go here, press X, go there, press X, you know, but that sort of thing. Anyhow, so they have the what they call the free world and the member world. So when you first start the game, you don't have to pay a cent. And then you have like this area, which is sort of the starter area, but quite, I mean, you could probably spend, as a kid, I spent hundreds of hours in that free section. And then if you want to, you can pay, I don't know if it's $5 or $10, and then you get access to, like, maybe say you get 20% of the game in the free version and then 80% of the game in the member section. And then you can just, you know, do all of it. And then you can play for as long as you want, and then you can go back to doing just the free stuff and then go back to be a member and switch back and forth as you want.
Man, have you, I don't think you mentioned this before, but this sounds exactly what I'm going to do with Sunset Moon. Release the free demo, and I've told you a million times on this podcast, you have this small area. Right. And now I talked to my former publisher last week or so, and he gave me some ideas and so on, and he suggested that I should do that first, and then maybe later on make this early access. So basically I start selling the game for maybe a bit cheaper than what the final product will be later on. But in this early access, you get access to more parts of the world. And then the early access community hopefully will help sort of balance the game or whatever. And then you release the full game later on. So the early access will get the full game for free, of course. And they bought it early, so they get it cheaper than people who buy it when the game is out. So anyway, that sounds like that, and that's cool. I think that's a good idea too. You give a free, it's kind of like a demo in terms of, you know, Square Enix is really good at this nowadays, to release demos so you get into the world, and then if you like it, you buy the whole game. Nintendo is also great at doing that. I played the Pikmin 4 demo with my son, and we were like, ah, this is really fun. And then I went out and bought the full game, and then I kept going on my save file.
Yeah.
Of course, when you play a story-driven game, or let's say an A to B kind of game where it's a finish line or whatever, you would have to do that sort of demo version of it. But in RuneScape, I suspect it's an open world type of game, so that makes sense to have this more like an era you can mess around in.
Yeah, absolutely. So I would say that it's really, really cool how they've done it. And since it's an open world game, it's sort of fun to see that playing through the years. When I started, say that the map was this big, and then now it's, you know, four times the size or something. Because at the edges of the map, it's just, there's no, like, they haven't built, like, mountains or anything to, you know, give the illusion that there is more, but you just can't go there. There is just a black line on the map there. This is where it's black, where it's nothing. And then if you go there in game, there is also, like, because they have, the whole game is sort of like a grid system. So on that line, there's just black and you can't go there. You can just look into the void. But then eventually, as they update the game, they add more area to the map. So where before there was just nothing there, then you see the map grow as you play the game, and you see there's more and more stuff added, and the world gets bigger, literally.
Cool. Which is really cool. In Sunset Moon, I have fences. I have a fence, like a literal fence, and then there's the NPCs who lives beyond the fence. They can walk through that, and it will open up for them, but the player cannot go through there.
Right.
Yeah, and that's also a little bit teasing the gamer a little bit. And then later on, the idea is to update the demo and the early access to push the fence back a little bit so you can access new places.
Yeah. Cool. I think one thing that I probably couldn't do a devil's advocate take on that I see anything positive with is loot boxes, which is feels like just gambling disguised as gaming. Because it's, you know, it's just, for those who don't know, basically it's like this. you get sort of, depending on the game, but usually you get something like every time you play a match or every time you complete a level or something, you get maybe 3 boxes or something, and then you have to pay to open them. So then you get to choose between which of these 3 do you want to, just like a slot machine, which one do you want to open, and then you open them, and then there's a chance that you get something really valuable that you can sell to other players, or it's really useful in the game or something. So then it works exactly like a slot machine. So then some people have like streaming channels of them just opening loot boxes. So it's just, you pay, you can also, beyond doing it in the game, like completing a level gets you a couple of loot boxes, because that's how they want to get you hooked. But they also allow you to buy packs of these, so you can buy like 1,400 bucks or something. And then you can just sit there and go and keep choosing a random box, and then eventually you might get something valuable. Maybe most of the time you probably don't. So it's just exactly like a slot machine. You pop quarters in there, and then you hope for a big win, but most of the time the house is gonna win. And, you know, this is also sort of connected to this whole using your dad's credit card and stuff. It feels like just, I'm sort of, usually I'm very lenient towards most monetization practices, but I totally understand like why you want to legislate this as if it were just gambling, because it feels like it is. Especially aimed toward kids. Feels so, and gambling also is, you know, there's a lot of people have actual like issues with it. They have an addiction, they can't help themselves, and all of a sudden they've, you know, they've sold their house or they've sold their car or whatever it is, and then they've ruined their life. And why would you want to enable that as a game developer? I don't see it as a positive thing in any shape or form.
The only good thing I sort of alluded to earlier would be that they use the money to make better games for without those loot boxes. But even that, we don't need that. Like, I know the whole idea to run a company is to make money ish but I think that even there you need to draw a line somewhere. Like, it's just like, well, at some point enough is a fucking enough, man. Like, at some point it's awful, those loot boxes system. But I feel like they are going away, or is it just that the industry is not talking about it as much? Because a couple of years ago I felt like every podcast I listened to back then talked about these things.
My guess is that there's just nobody talking about it. As I understand it, like Counter-Strike and a lot of these games still have it. I don't think it's going away, but I think it's not a shock to people to find out that there is such things. That's sort of funny, because I think in so many ways RuneScape sort of characterizes a lot of these issues, because they had the main game which kept updating and, you know, kept growing for many, many years. And you know, for me growing up, I started at some point and then played it all until adulthood, still play it now and then. And then eventually people sort of got enough of it, because they started enabling this loot boxes shit, and you know, everything became more and more like all of the practices that I think you and me don't like with games, that there's just money. The money incentive is the first thing, not making a good game and then making, as a byproduct, making money from that. And then eventually then people started talking about, I wish we could go back to the good old days of this game, because it was so, so much better than whatever we have now. And then eventually, after voting, I think because they did a vote whether they should do this or not. And then I think it was something like, maybe I'll post it on screen, but something like 90-something percent wanted to have the old version. So what they did is that they found an old backup of a game, of the game from 2007. So they worked a lot to make that playable, and then everyone could just start from scratch from that. And then that, of course, got going, and that started its separate track. So it's sort of fun that you have the main game, which is, you know, like beautiful graphics, and it's you know, ray tracing, and it's voice acting, and it's so many things. And then you have the 2007 version, which people like for its old style. So it's, you know, I love the graphics, but they do look like shit. And you know, there's so many things that's very old and archaic about it, but that's what people like about it. And as I understand it, more people are playing that than the newer game. So where was I going with this? Yes, so loot boxes, I guess. So RuneScape also had like a version where they did, you know, almost cave because of, you know, the only traffic they got is these people who want loot boxes and want this, you know, not the quality of the game, but rather just the, I don't know, fast and cheap stuff, I guess, that makes money.
Is there any statistics on how many people play the new version versus the old one, the 2007? Where did the most audience go?
Yeah. Let me see here if I can find something. Let's see. I'll share my screen so I can perhaps put this in the episode. Let's see if this works. So I think you should see now. So this is somebody asking, according to this at... So this is the RuneScape forums, and he says, the first poster says, the RuneScape 3, so RuneScape 3 is the new RuneScape, basically, and OSRS is, it's short for Old School RuneScape, which is the 2007 version. So he says, the RuneScape 3 online numbers on the main page combined with the Old School RuneScape are... Or is it blah, blah, blah. Anyhow, he asks, is it really the real numbers that you're seeing? Because they usually have a player count on the respective homepage for each game. So, and according to this, then, at the 7th of July in 2023, says that the numbers for the new game, the one with microtransactions and stuff, is... 855,000 roughly, and then the new game has 2.2 million if I'm seeing right.
But that's 3 million in total.
Yeah, exactly. It's a huge game. So let's see here if I can find some from this page that it's mentioning. Let's see. List.
I've only heard you talk about this game, but I suppose this is a PC Master Race type of game. It's not on console, is it?
Okay, let's see here. It is on mobile, actually. So they had a big thing where they actually released it on mobile. So you can actually play it on iPhone and Android. So, and iPad, I guess, too. It hasn't come to mobile because it's a very click-heavy game. So I don't think... it would work well with a controller because you have to click everything, basically. And that works with a finger, but yeah. So let's just quickly look at the player count for... this is the new game, like the RuneScape, just RuneScape. So let's see here. Here says last month it had a peak about around 350,000 people is what it looks like. And peak on yearly is about 900,000 I guess, per month. A million, almost a million in a single month is in the top. So let's look at then the old school one and let's see how it compares. So let's see. Okay, so Last month, it's $1 million per month is roughly what they do every month. So, and on yearly, it's $2 million a peak. So you can see probably if you compare the two, that it's quite a difference. Mm. So here it's total players, 47 million, daily players, 1.35. And here it's total player, it's, I don't know, if it, is it half perhaps? And then daily players is, it's a tenth. So, yeah, that goes to show that the good old days, they're not so bad after all.
No, but how do they make money of the old version?
So, as I understand it, they have the, you have just one subscription, and then you get access to both games. So you get to choose which one you play. So basically, vote with your feet, so to speak.
Mm.
So, yeah. So that's how they do it.
Cool.
Yeah. So it goes to show, like, if you just ruin the game with microtransactions and all of that stuff, it can be really toxic to yourself in the long run, I would say.
Yeah. I think, yeah, man, just, it all goes back to things were better before, or, the more natural things are, the better in some weird way. And I think the same goes with games and everything.
Exactly. But I'm thinking still, though, that we're in total agreement about games as a product is the superior way to do it. But imagine that you're a, say, mid-sized company. You're 20 people or something, or 10 people. And you make a game, it doesn't sell as much. And then you have, you know, it's your dream to have a game company, basically. And you also believe in this. You want to make the sort of stuff you, I don't know if it's a real quote or not, but people say that Gandhi said something like, be the change you want to see in the world.
Mm.
And you live by that, but the numbers just aren't there. And you can either, you have the choices of like, either just start firing people, like maybe your friends that you started this company with, and then you can either, or if you don't do that, you will go bankrupt. So then you will just have nothing and then have to start over all again, if you even can. And then you have the choice of just add skins to the game. And then there's some addicts that buy the game, buy the skins or whatever it is. And then you get to flourish as a company or at least survive to make another game.
Mm.
And it's not good choices, but I wouldn't say that it's completely easy to make what is the right choice.
Yeah. But well, I had something I've been thinking about recently. Well, I talked to someone and I said I don't let my son watch any YouTube at all. There's zero YouTube, zero screen time. Only on Fridays we watch a movie together, or sometimes in a weekday when we do this podcast, for example. But and then this person said, "Well, why just YouTube? Well, why do you don't mind Netflix, but you do mind YouTube?" And I said, well, there's no end to YouTube. It's just a continuous stream of shit, and it never ends. And it's just addicting in terms of how the statistics looks like. And the YouTube creators, they make stuff based on that. And it just never ends. It's just like a constant dopamine kick that never ends.
Yeah.
And that's just not healthy. Whilst a movie, we have movie night on Fridays, it has an end, 1.5 hour, and then it ends. And my counter argument, well, what I don't like about this microtransaction, so you sort of mentioned it twice that you have these addicted people. Well, is that a good thing though? Is that a good thing that we have these addicted people? They just keep buying shit. And like, and then if we zoom out again and not think about, if you don't put myself in the center, like this is my company, I need to survive. If I just step back a little bit, do I want to live in a world full of addicted people who just buy my shit? And then it sort of goes into this whole idea, what happens when 1% of the world have everything? The rest will just fucking come and get you. So I don't know. It's some maybe like you mentioned this Buddhist guy, but even that, I do think that At some point, especially in the West, I noticed a lot this individuality and shit. It's like everyone is just a selfish prick. I think we just need to step back a little bit and think about all of us. What is good for all of us? So I would say, as boring as it sounds, that it would probably be better for all of us if games were just products. Like, that's it. You play it, you finish it, you move on, or something like that. Instead of like this... Instead of trying to get people hooked, because I just don't think that's good for humanity long term.
Yeah.
But it's fucking great for a company short term. But I wonder sometimes if what's best. I think it's best games as a product, just for in every way, shape, or form. But that being said, like I started off with this episode, I do see the point with the if you can make these microtransactions and so on that you could that can fund your other games. But even with my recent argument, that wouldn't matter anyway. If that's bad for society or humanity as a whole, then you wouldn't want that anyway. However, I would say a good compromise, I like to always try to think about some sort of compromise in some way, that a good compromise would be that you have some regulation that says in terms of microtransactions, you can only spend $20 a month or something like that. And this goes from, I don't know, the country you live in or something, and then the companies have to apply for that. And that sounds super anti freedom and super anti, what would you call it, free market and so on. But at the same time, again, if we step back one step and look at the whole, maybe that's better for all of us. And also, I always bitch and whine about this, it will also teach people patience. Imagine if you can only spend $20 a microtransaction. Let's say this is linked to your PlayStation account and there's a ticker there. And when you're at $20, you have to wait until next month. You bloody need that, man, because we're so addicted and so bad at having patience and waiting for shit. We just want. So as a whole, that could be a solution. Sounds super, I don't know, borderline communist here, but I think that's a good solution.
Well, first of all, Gandhi was not Buddhist, so there's that. Anyhow, I would say we're getting into a different kind of argument here, but I think that if you would limit it to $20, then you would just create a black market for it. You know, how easy wouldn't it be to just buy login credentials from another person who somehow, you know, got his hands on, you know, this many skins, or his, you know, purchase over maybe this one guy, you know, creates 10 accounts and then buys $20 of those each for a month for like a year, and then he has 10 accounts he can sell for a bunch of money, or he can sell the skins or something.
But why would I want to buy your black market account, because I can't get those skins over to my Sea of Thieves account?
I imagine that games wouldn't have like one skin per month that you could buy. Probably you could have more than, you know, say that you have 100 skins per month, that feels, you know, possible. And then if you have like 10 accounts, then you have maybe 20 of the rare ones or something. And then the chance of getting that is not 100% each month. So, I think it's just, it's going to create a bigger problem. I think somewhere, I heard somebody say this, but that you have to deal with the world as it is, not as you would like it to be. And I think for me, that means that unfortunately, there's always going to be addicts. Doesn't matter what it is. All kinds of substances and all kinds of gambling and other things. So I think you're never going to solve that problem altogether.
Would that mean, like, let's say in my communist regime world where I rule, I say companies can only allow users to spend, well, I put it to $100 a month on microtransactions. Yeah. That means that I still think that could help, especially for kids, because I'm not sure if they would try to get into some black market just to get some fucking skins. But whatever. I hear your point. And I guess in my rule, my world, addicts are still addicts, so maybe they will just go and be addict to something else. If I stop them from being addicts in video games, they will just go to a real life casino and waste their cash there, maybe. Who knows?
Yeah. I think there's a saying in Sweden which is something like, the load of the vices are constant, meaning that if you quit, as you say, if you quit smoking, then you'll just start, I don't know, chewing tobacco, for example. Mm. That you will always have this one thing, and that feels plausible that, you know, as I say, maybe you're pushing them out of buying skins online and then into, like, real addiction for something else, something more dangerous, perhaps. Mm. I don't know if that's the case or not, but I think that there's... It would be fun if more developers, of course, did what you want the market to be, which is games as a product. But I think at the same time, there's, as with any market, there's not ever going to be room for everyone. There's always going to be this thing which you talked about earlier, but has an actual name, creative destruction, which means, for example, in a financial crash, that the companies that can't adapt to market changes, they die. So that's creative destruction. So then the ones that can adapt are rewarded with less competition for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, I guess, I think
that's also, yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I guess that's probably the best way moving forward, not to do anything and just let, again, the truth, whatever that is, win. And that would be long-term what's going to happen, even though I like to think that we can help people short-term. I suppose that's... So I'm counter-arguing myself before one. Whatever, but short-term, it could maybe help people, but long-term is not. And the best way forward would just to allow these whales or these addicted people to keep fucking themselves over. But maybe long-term, the winning companies will be the ones that actually make good shit, and then those will be rewarded, and that good stuff has no microtransactions and all these things in it.
And I think it's not speaking as somebody who has released a paid game, so I can't speak to that, but what it feels to me is that you sort of have to stick to your guts and just do what you think is right. And I think if you really want more games as a product, then I guess just make it as a product if you can, and then don't put it on sale at all, is what I would recommend. Factorio is a great example of that. You just have a no sale policy, and that people buy it anyhow, because it feels like if you do put it on sale, you're competing with like Ubisoft, which has like a back catalog of 1,000 games. So then they could just, Ubisoft Weekend, and then we have 140 titles, which are 75% off. And, you know, here are you with this indie game, and it's 50% off. And, you know, why are they even going to buy it? And then if they are going to buy it, they'll just look up statistics of what your game has costed in the past, and then if you have it on sale too early, then they know that, okay, it's been on sale for 75%, I'm just going to put it in the wish list and buy it when it's on sale. So if it's always 10 bucks or whatever it is, then people expect that, okay, it's no point waiting. If I want it, it's just buy it or don't buy it. This is what it costs. It's no timing thing.
Yeah.
And I think that's also something that you should do. And also, I think as a consumer, I mean, this is always so people talk about, like, oh, consumer have to do this to make blah, blah, blah. It's never going to happen because people are what they are, and they're not going to have like some abstract philosophy as their first incentive. But if you want to do something, I would guess buy games as a product and not as a service, and don't pay for DLC or microtransactions or stuff like that.
I don't. I always wait for the, especially nowadays, I only wait for the Game of the Year editions or whatever, so I get all in one. I refuse to buy these things and stuff like that. And I also think it's just, I don't understand how you can start playing a game, you finish it, and 2 months later a DLC comes and you go back. It's just weird, in my opinion, especially when it's a game as a product, like a Horizon, for example, or The Last of Us. I want the whole deal in one go. But yeah, it's interesting that thing with don't put your game on sale and so on. That was my philosophy. But of course, I have a publisher, so the deal is usually that we put the games on sales. But moving forward, I hope to be... I'm going to publish my own games, and that's going to be... Well, Sunset Moon, I hope, is going to be that game that will never go on sale. It's a one-time purchase, and it's never going to go on sale, and so on. Because I think that sends the right signals to the gamer, and also you don't they don't have to feel like they missed out, or you know, you buy a game and the next day it goes on 50% sale. That sucks, that kind of stuff. So it's just it feels more honest towards the gamers, and it feels more honest to yourself, and it feels more, you're being more honest and real to your competition. So it's kind of friendly competition. If you don't put your games on sales, on sale, you help other developers too. But a lot of developers put their games on 99% sale, so it gets to the front page and you cheat the system and so on. It's a sad, but it is what it is.
Yeah, it's like that that saying, or I don't know what it is, but it's like if you sell your game at 99%, sure, you've won, but at what cost? And with that, I think it's time to wrap up the episode. Did you have anything else, or what do you think?
No, it was good fun. Got very some conspiracy theories in there. We got some pointless arguments from my behalf, which I had to backtrack. Got some... what is it called? Dictatorship-ism in this episode. Good stuff, good stuff.
Very good. Yeah, I think that's it for the episode. Leave a voicemail if you have anything to say about microtransactions and loot boxes.
I had a dream that we got a voice message.
Ooh, nice. Exciting. What did it say?
I don't remember. I just remember when we started recording today, I remember that I dreamt that we had a voice message in a previous episode.
It's an omen. It's going to happen.
A couple of days ago. Yeah, it will happen.
Cool. Yeah. Exactly. Leave a comment, a voice message, a letter in my mailbox, whatever it is. Just let us know what you think about this episode. Don't dox me. And I think that's it for the episode. Have a good one.
Sayonara!